This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. Military lawyers have made Canadian history in the Sydney courtroom. A look beneath the ocean water around Cape Breton, where creatures are both hunted and feared. We have some financial tips for a fun, inexpensive summer. The Hat is featuring a documentary looking at newcomers making roots on the island. You'll hear about a prom alternative where people can be themselves, and Member 2 welcomes provincial funding to fight climate change. These stories are coming up on the Coast. Lawyers representing an Indigenous Cape Breton Highlander are commenting on how her culture's practices were incorporated in a court-martial for the first time in Canadian history. The Coast 89.7's Jacob Postlewaite reports.
Cape Breton Highlander Corporal Kendra Christmas recently appeared before a military court-martial at the Victoria Armouries in Sydney, where she faced charges of sexual assault against another service member, dishonourable behaviour, and drunkenness. The charges stemmed from an incident in March 2019 at the Truro Armouries. After a two-week trial and month-long deliberation, Christmas was acquitted of the sexual assault and dishonorable behavior charges and found guilty of drunkenness. It was by all accounts a standard court-martial. However, certain changes were made to accommodate and respect Christmas's Indigenous cultural heritage and practices. Following the verdict, lawyers representing Christmas spoke about how her culture's practices were incorporated into a court-martial for the first time in Canadian history. Major Carlos De Cruz and Lieutenant Colonel Andreas Bullock represented Christmas at the trial. De Cruz says after learning Christmas was Indigenous, they discovered a gap in the military legal system.
Basically, what we identified was that there's a gap in the regulations. If you look at our Queen's regulations and orders, they list out two ways that you can become, you know, to testify as a witness and how to indicate that you'll tell the truth. One is through a religious oath, and the other is through an affirmation, non-religious. Historically, we use the Bible, the Christian Bible, as part of the religious oath. That seemed to be the de facto norm. So for our client, that wouldn't work. So we found an opportunity here to bring this to the court's attention.
De Cruz says they found this gap to be an opportunity to address these concerns, and after receiving approval from Christmas, the two lawyers raised the issue with the trial judge, military judge Colonel Stephen Strickey, who invited them to make a formal application. De Cruz says while making the application, they looked to the use of Indigenous practices in other courts outside of the military.
So we brought a formal written application earlier this year. When we attended for the application, we brought all the evidence that we needed to bring in support of the application. While it's the first of its kind that we're aware of in the military justice system, that's not to say that we're the first in Canada across all courts. In fact, we were modeling our application from other courts in Canada, including Nova Scotia, where the use of certain Indigenous practices had already been incorporated, like the use of the sacred eagle feather. And so for our client, the sacred eagle feather was a very important mechanism to allow proper participation at the court-martial.
When Christmas took the stand to testify in the trial, she swore her oath on a sacred eagle feather. The court also adopted the oath that came alongside the eagle feather. Christmas held an eagle feather while she testified and continued to hold it following her testimony. Smudging ceremonies were also conducted in the morning before the day's proceedings would begin. De Cruz says the unit in Nova Scotia worked with them to source an eagle feather. He also pointed out that military court-martials are ad hoc with no standing court, making each court-martial different, so other court-martials could incorporate Indigenous practices in other ways or forms in the future. De Cruz then shared his personal feelings about having been a part of the effort to incorporate Indigenous practices.
I don't know if it's set in just yet. We, as defense counsel, we do everything for our clients within our arcs, obviously, professional and ethical, to make sure that they're properly represented in court. So, you know, Obviously, I'm quite supportive of this application, but our job as defense counsel is to advance our client's interests, and we did that here. It happens to be that our personal views are 100% aligned with our clients, and as it turns out, with this court martial. So it's good for our client, rather than saying, you know, that this is a me or an us thing. This is really a great outcome for our client, but also for other Indigenous members in the Canadian Forces who may find themselves, having to deal with a matter at a court martial. So this was a great opportunity for Indigenous people and reconciliation with Canada. It's a small, but I would say an important milestone that we're now aligning ourselves with our civilian counterparts.
The trial has not yet concluded. Christmas will return to the court martial on August 19th for sentencing.
On July 7th, the Highland Arts Theatre will host Des and Arden Ong's documentary You Are Here, which follows eight newcomers from their first arrival to Cape Breton up to where they are now. Dialogue's Cora Perrigo catches up with Des and Arden about the importance of telling these kinds of stories.
So what is You Are Here? What was the story behind it?
Right. So You Are Here is a documentary about newcomers where we followed like eight new immigrants in CBRM from the moment they arrived until like how their life is going on, like currently going. Yeah.
How did you find the newcomers?
Right. So we, like myself, I work around like the local immigration as a volunteer, community volunteer. I'm connected with a CBLIP like local immigration partnership, specifically with the immigrant advisory table, and I also sit on the board for the Multicultural Association of Cape Breton with Ocean, and so I do a lot of like community work around local immigration, and from there we meet a lot of people like us, new immigrants as well, in CBRM, and that's where we you know, when you're like new to a place and then you are living in a different like life situations with everybody else, you're curious about, like, yes, we're all new immigrants, but then you're curious about how their life is going. So I think that's where we have that like inspiration to like pursue stories.
So yeah, so it's kind of like that, where it's a similar story but so vastly different between each story. What kind of moments did you have in the making of this documentary that like really touched you or really showed you the difference but the similarity in your experiences?
Right. So I think so we talked to not just one or two people. We talked to eight different people. So just because really curious, like how different or how similar we are as new immigrants in CBRM. And what we found are, I think the touching moments there would be like people who are away from their families from back home, and then the time difference that that they like have to deal with to really keep that connection with their family. So those are deep like reflections, but also like even like simple reflections that from newcomers who are coming from like in a different environment, like fresh air is like very new to them, and so like the things you don't think about, and then it comes from with the interview. So like it's really like very good to hear, and like really, oh, you don't notice it, but then you hear from it, and then like, oh yeah, so like deeper awareness and understanding about each other in the community.
It sounds like you had your own experiences, you were curious about other experiences. How did you want to get into kind of storytelling?
Right, so we own a storytelling business as well. It's called Sari Sari Story, and so we really, our background is like advertising, marketing, kind of storytelling. Arden's like filmmaker back in the Philippines. So we're our combined like interest and also like maybe storytelling backgrounds in different capacity led us to, I think, mostly curiosity is what we're like really have with us. And then again, and that led us to again like really pursue stories that's like similar, and we share experiences. But then again, like I know I have this like thinking about like the immigrant story that it's not the same with everybody else.
It's interesting, you were a filmmaker in the Philippines. Did you want to speak on that a little?
Yeah, I'm heavily involved in doing films back home. So just like what Des said, I was a filmmaker there, and then when we got here 6 years ago, I thought of telling a story about the island and about the newcomers, because when we got here, I was hoping to be involved in doing films again, just like what my experience back home. But unfortunately, there wasn't enough opportunities when we came here 6 years ago. So we worked at McDonald's. I worked at a fast food restaurant until we got our PR. And while I was working there, it came up to me like, what a wonderful idea to do a story about newcomers who's having the same experiences as me. Because I know from that point that it's not only me who's experiencing like the difficulties of getting a job from your former experience. So that led to this story, the You Are Here project.
And why You Are Here?
Yeah, I think it's based on a book that I was reading that it's like You Are Here. It captures like where, how far you've come from the moment you arrive and then how your life is going like now. So I think that's where like You Are Here, that it's gonna be different for everybody, but it's You Are Here in the island. And when you watch the documentary too, it's like capturing everyone's like heart that they want to be here. Yeah,
it's interesting. When I saw the title, my interpretation was almost when you're lost in a like a building or on like a hiking trail, you find a map and there's a You Are Here. Is that kind of a connection as well?
It can be like all the different
Like for me, the title You Are Here, like what Des said, it came from a book. It was a line from a book.
Yeah.
You Are Here. It wasn't the title. It was a line. And she read it out loud to me, and I was like, that's the title, You Are Here. Because I feel like for that documentary alone, I sincerely hope that immigrants like me, newcomers like me, will find their identity in whichever part of the story that would be, whether you're a recent newcomer, you've been 5 years here, or even you can see yourself as one of the locals that we interview that would help you manifest your dreams here.
When you said you hope the newcomers kind of see themselves reflected in it, what do you hope a local kind of takes away? Someone who's watching and who hasn't had that experience, what do you hope they take away from it?
When I was editing this film, I knew right away that the story that always comes up while I was doing this project is that what a wonderful community we can have. It's beautiful here now, but it can even be more beautiful when locals and newcomers come together. The island would be so much more beautiful than what we currently have right now.
Are you able to speak about kind of some of the newcomers you've interviewed? Are you able to kind of share a couple stories?
I think generally the ones that I shared earlier too were the stories where one of the who works here in New Dawn like shared how like really the struggle where your kid's like so far away from you and that you're a mom and that how do you deal with those things, and you're also like trying to cope with like the new environment and new culture and new like everything. And then another one was really kind of simple reflections where language is a barrier for a lot of us who's like English is not our first language. So those challenges at the start, and then seeing them as from that the first challenge that they have, and then going through their like life, and then now they're more confident like speaking, and then they're more and it's like it's because of like the people around them. It's the community around them. It's CBRM who really welcome them. And so that's a reflection we share as well. That's why we're doing this story, because we were welcomed here in CBRM and we feel home. And that's also some of the reflections that came out from the documentary as well. Yeah.
What do you feel is the importance of sharing newcomer stories?
I mean, I think because we don't see it a lot out there. And I think offering that diverse perspectives and diverse stories just kind of helps reflect how our community is here in CBRM. Like, all of us are immigrants unless you are Mi'kmaq. So really sharing those kinds of stories and like putting it out there makes us like really understand others in the community in general. Yeah.
That's such an interesting, true perspective. All of us except for the Mi'kmaq are immigrants. Is that kind of something that you touch on in the documentary, or something you kind of want people to take away from?
Yeah, we kind of touch on that in a little bit in the documentary too. Yeah.
And is there any kind of part of the process that surprised you, or that you found yourself kind of emotionally affected by that you weren't expecting?
It sparked us to kind of pursue more stories like that, not specifically like newcomer stories that all the time, but also like curiosity around, for example, that reflection on we're all immigrants. So we're like, oh, yes, of course, yes. And then so like that's another story that we can pursue like after the documentary. So now we're like doing other projects and keeping that in mind. So like it's all of the reflections mentioned in the documentary like really sparks us to have different more stories to follow too. Yeah.
Is there anything kind of like pie in the sky? Is there any kind of subject, if money was no object, if time was no object, is there anything you'd like to make a documentary or make a piece about?
I would say probably I would turn this into a full feature, since it's a nice piece coming from a documentary, which is real life, raw emotions and everything like that. And if you can pull that and transfer it into a full length feature, I think it would be nice, and it would be a powerful piece, especially not just here in the island, but all over the world. I mean, immigrants and newcomers are being, I wouldn't say attacked, but there's a lot of problems around the world about this issue that I hope this documentary can put a light on.
And I think to add to that, because it's a beautiful piece where everybody's like reflecting their life here on the island. So it's a good thing to share across the province as well, or even like around Canada, that, hey, if you go here, this is going to be your experience as a newcomer on the island. So it's good to share that piece as well in other places.
And are you guys open to collaboration with other like artists on the island or other organizations?
Oh, yeah, for sure. We are eager to collaborate with everyone. Yeah.
Where can people find more information about you?
So personally for us, we have a website like sarisaristory.com, and then we have Facebook and Instagram, sarisaristory video. Yeah.
And that's S-A-R-I-S-A-R-I?
S-A-R-I-S-A-R-I-S-C-O-R-Y, yes.
Perfect. And where can people see the documentary?
Right. So the documentary is made possible by the Cape Breton Connector Program and the Cape Breton Welcome Network. And it's going to be on Monday, July 7th at 6 p.m. at the Highland Arts Theater at the Hat in Sydney. Yeah.
Is there anything else you wanted to add? Anything you want people to think about going into the documentary?
I think so they need to kind of register to get tickets and to come in for the screening. So they need to go to the Facebook page of Cape Breton Connector Program for to get tickets.
Fisheries and Oceans Canada says shark sightings are increasing in the waters off of Cape Breton. DFO scientist Warren Joyce says the average number of sightings over the past decade has increased from 6 to 12. He says social media plays a large part. More and more people are bringing their phones on board with equipment ready to capture footage. Choi says, plus, recent studies are showing their numbers are increasing.
We conducted a study with some sharks that had been acoustically tagged. And most of this is using some data from our U.S. colleagues who have tagged over 400 over the years. And basically, I didn't do the analysis myself, so I can't speak much to that. But it was basically looking at sharks that entered Canadian waters, these tagged sharks. And we had seen an increase since 2019.
A recent viral social media video shows a great white shark nearly 5 meters long off the shores of Inverness. Joy says it likely came here to hunt for a variety of food sources.
When they get to a certain size, they're mainly looking for marine mammals. So things like seals or harbor porpoise or things like that, as well as other large fish like tunas and whatnot. So we have an abundance of those species up here that they can feed on.
Choi says there is also a variety of sharks visiting the region.
Blue shark, which is probably our most common large shark that we have in Atlantic Canada. There would be poor beagle, there'd be mako, Greenland shark, white shark, basking sharks. A variety of deep water sharks are found off the coast. So quite a few.
The shark was spotted in the same general area of a 2021 attack, seriously injuring a 21-year-old woman. Joy says the sharks can often look the other way if they see someone in the water, although some species are more aggressive than others.
Probably the two that would be, I guess, most concerned would be the white shark and the mako shark, the sharkfin mako. But all sharks, or most of the shark species we have around here, they're fairly large animals, and they are wild animals. So, I mean, the potential is there, but it's usually quite rare that they would attack a human. They're more often likely to just, if they see something as large as a human, just go the other way.
Joyce says sharks have a bad reputation, and they have become even more notorious since the release of a blockbuster film in the 1970s.
People have always been kind of fearful of sharks, especially after the movie Jaws came out. But I would say in more recent years, people have grown to have a fascination with them. More people certainly do want to see them around. People are always curious about them and fascinated about them. And, I hear from commercial fishermen, they like to have them here to eat some of the seals.
Joyce returns to the different types of sharks we have in the waters around Cape Breton and how it is wise to respect their habitat where we are the visitors and to look out for seals because that's where you can often find a shark.
There have been some cases up by Inverness that I know, certainly basking sharks, one of the largest species of shark that we do have in our waters, which are usually quite harmless. I know that there's been some of them sighted off Cape Breton. I believe it was last year, there was a white shark that was acting kind of erratic that ended up beaching itself. If you're entering the water, you're taking a risk. There's literally thousands of sharks off our waters, from blue sharks to poor beagles to white sharks. So if you're going in the water, you are taking some sort of a risk. That's their playground, and we're just visitors. I would say that some of the best things to do is just not go in by yourself. Don't go in where there's any seal activity, like if there's seals around. And just to keep an eye out, if you see anything, get out of the water and use some common sense.
Joy says, although many people believe sharks are the king of the watery jungle, the creatures that have been around for about 400 million years also find themselves as victims from time to time.
Certainly, yes, they do. The number one would be man. Going out fishing for them. But natural predators would be other large sharks. In terms of a white shark, orcas would certainly take them. There has been some recent activity in South Africa where there was some really good footage online of a couple of killer whales coming in and attacking a fairly large white shark.
Many people kill sharks simply for their fins to make shark fin soup. Joy says this is appalling activity.
I know it's been banned in Canada for a number of years. So we don't allow them to just take shark fins. For taking an animal just for a part of it, I don't agree with really.
Meanwhile, turning to legal seafood, lobster season is well underway. A Glace Bay fisherman says prices and weather have rebounded since the start of the season. Herb Nash says the season in Lobster Fishing Area 27 started with some rough weather in mid-May and questionable prices around $7.50 a pound, but he says now they are enjoying a price hike of 50 cents per pound.
Decent price is good. Price is up to $8 a pound I just done my log. I can tell you the date went up 8 hours. I had a college fish plan that I didn't know myself, eh? And, went 8 hours on the 16th of June and still had 8 hours, the 7:50 the rest of the first 2 weeks of June, and then went 8 hours the last 2 weeks of June.
As for the weather, opening day was postponed, and there was some choppy weather when they first started the season. But he says they basically have fished every day except for Sundays. Nash explains why the day of rest is important.
We never missed a day since once the weather got good and that. I set my traps on May the 16th, and from the 17th, May the 17th to now, the only day we miss is Sundays. Nobody goes on Sunday. If someone goes, the rest of them would be mad at them and argue, fight with them that day. So understanding that we don't fish on Sunday. I would say it's a gentleman's agreement because fishers don't come checking to see if anyone's fishing on Sunday. Now and then, if someone breaks down through the week, they'll go on a Sunday. If they miss 2 or 3 days through the week. Yeah, but other than that, there, like Sunday, everybody stays in on Sunday. So far, the weather's good, and everybody's getting 5 or 6 days a week, and they're happy with that.
Nash says they're winding down with the season. It's set to end in mid-July. He refers to his logbook to explain some days on the water are better than others.
I had 820, 586, 601, 774, 534, 621, and 700, 600, 500, 400, 250, 193, them 2 days it was bad. And then got 861, 613, 542, and then 346, 343, and 300. It dropped a little bit there, them 3 days. And back to 554 Monday, that was 2 days fishing, though, like we don't fish Sunday. Then 237, 188, and then 368 today, so... They're not bad, you know, like at $8 a pound, you're making enough to, you know, pay your bills and pay your helpers and everything, eh?
At the Glace Bay Harbor, across the Atlantic Ocean, all the way to Asia, Nash applauds Victoria Co-op fisheries representatives who are looking for new customers as a result of U.S. President Donald Trump's tariff threats. General Manager Osborne Burke is attending the Taipei International Food Show in Taiwan. He says it's his latest stop overseas after attending shows in Spain and South Korea, looking for new customers to make up for lost business with the Americans. He says the president has created uncertainty and he's unpredictable.
That was a wake-up call for a lot of companies in Canada, not just seafood, with the threat of tariffs, and they're still there at the moment because the Mar-a-Lago bully, you can't trust anything he's going to say. He could wake up tomorrow and change tunes.
Burke says he's excited about a deal in the works, but can't reveal many details at this time.
Now our Taiwan show, it looks like one of the largest importers into Taiwan is very interested, and tentatively we've got agreement on order for product if we can squeeze it in before the end of the lobster season.
Burke says drastic changes are required because traditionally 65% of their sales come from the USA. Province is supporting Indigenous efforts in Cape Breton to fight climate change. Dialogue's Jacob Postlewaite was a member too for the news conference.
Minister of Innu Affairs Leah Martin made an announcement on behalf of Environment and Climate Change Minister Timothy Hallman for an investment into the Unamagi Institute of Natural Resources.
We know that the climate crisis is touching every corner of our province, but it does not impact each community in the same way. And today, we are here to support the leadership and recognize that the path forward must be shaped in partnership and guided with Etiwakimuk Tuwaitseyeng. I am proud to announce that the province is providing $893,750 to the Unamagi Institute of Natural Resources to support Mi'kmaq-led climate action. This investment will help develop a regional climate action plan, hire a Mi'kmaq climate change coordinator and project assistant, create educational materials founded on Mi'kmaq knowledge, and develop a monitoring program based on culturally relevant indicators. This is about building solutions that are rooted in Mi'kmaq ways of knowing and putting local communities in the lead. Climate change is real and it is urgent, and it is affecting all of us.
She went on to say that the recent wildfires Nova Scotia has seen are a heartbreaking reminder of how serious and unpredictable the effects of climate change can be. The Unimaki Institute of Natural Resources represents Cape Breton's five Mi'kmaq communities to be their voice on natural resources and the environment. The institute works to integrate traditional Mi'kmaq management and conventional ways of understanding, an approach known as two-eyed seeing. The institute's executive director, Lisa Young, was also at the announcement and says the new programs will provide the institute the capacity and resources to work with the five Mi'kmaq communities in Cape Breton and apply their lens to addressing climate change.
Using a two-eyed seeing approach, UINR is helping to identify solutions that meet the unique needs of our communities, like Member 2, while helping to maintain the ecological integrity of our environment. It is through the guidance of two-eyed seeing that Mi'kmaq values and belief systems inform what we do, and more importantly, inform why we do things in a way that's mindful of the land and our relationships with the land.
Also in attendance was Member 2 Chief Terry Paul, who shared his feelings about the investment.
Very heartwarming, and certainly finally get to know a place where we are actually tackled with climate change. And part of the reason why we formed the Unimaki Institute of Natural Resources, because we really, really are concerned about the state of the climate, and we are very, very much, you know, have the island, all of the island, in our thoughts. And so with this program, you know, it's going to do a lot to help the climate, and I think the results will show very quickly when we work together that we're able to ensure that the what we do with the environment is sustainable.
Following the announcement, the speakers took questions from the media about the investment. Martin discussed what she hopes will come out of the partnership between the province and the institute.
You know, the great work, the culturally appropriate KPIs, and you know, the support of the program positions that are being funded through this will continue to do great work through two-eyed seeing. So essentially, Indigenous-led approaches to climate action is what I'm hoping to see and continue to support. So I think when we lean into the knowledge that's around us through Indigenous communities, we're in a good place, I feel, in a safe space, and our province agrees. And that's why we have great collaboration with the Unimaki Institute as well.
Young says the investment is important to help the Institute build capacity to tackle climate change head on. She says the work has already started.
We already are doing some work. So we did start about a year ago, I believe. So a lot of the community engagement is currently underway and is wrapping up. And we kind of see the next steps as kind of going back with them. And like I said, identifying specific projects that they might need some support in tackling and getting underway.
Chief Paul says the focus should be on the next generation.
This funding will help us, you know, address those concerns, you know, and gain a lot more knowledge about the system so that we can do things that doesn't harm it, you know. So we want to work towards helping out the climate. As we all know, it is definitely changing. So we have to do things to help mitigate those climate issues. And not only for us, our generation, but for the next generations to come, you know, and that's where our thoughts are always are, to make sure that our children that are coming will have a better place to go.
The funding is being provided through Nova Scotia's Climate Change Plan, Our Climate, Our Future, Nova Scotia's Climate Change Plan for Clean Growth. The province says this announcement advances Actions 8 and 53 of the plan, which is to support both Indigenous and African Nova Scotian communities to address climate change inequities.
Every year, the Youth Project welcomes their queer prom, a prom alternative for youth who don't feel safe or comfortable being themselves at one of the others hosted by the schools. Dialogue's Cora Perrigo speaks with Cass Bootlier and Isaac Coates about why, as the world changes, queer prom is still so needed.
How, kind of, what's the advent of queer prom? What was the beginning?
Queer prom started because a lot of youth that go to the regular proms often feel excluded or feel like they can't wear what they feel most comfortable in or can't bring the people that they want to bring and, you know, hold hands or just be at the prom and feel comfortable. So queer prom was created to fill in that gap and to create a space, a safe space for queer folks to go and celebrate their prom.
And so, how did queer proms get started at the Youth Project?
Queer prom has been here for a long time. Madonna was the person who first initiated the queer prom. And for a very long time, it's been the Youth Project just like leading it. And even before COVID, queer prom was a thing. So after COVID, things took a while to get back up. But this year was phenomenal. And it's going to be here for a very long time.
So what do you think is the importance of still continuing it, even as things, you know, progress where people can bring the people that they want to bring to prom or people can dress up, like as things get more open, what do you think is still the importance of having it?
I think even though it is, you know, becoming more socially acceptable to be queer, I think politically, there's still a long way to go, and sometimes it even feels like we're moving backwards. So I feel like now more than ever, we need those spaces for queer folks to be able to express themselves and to be with the people they want to be with.
I also think it's a wonderful experience socially. We get to have queer youth from all over Ugamaki, Cape Breton, come to one spot and interact and share experiences, and it's really such a lovely night. For folks who across Cape Breton wouldn't get the chance to see folks from other schools. So
So it also kind of functions even more so than a kind of a safe space prom, kind of in a way. It also functions as a opportunity for connection with people that maybe they haven't met before.
Absolutely. And we get to see here at the Youth Project friendships flourish from that. And people who even just met at queer prom end up just being friends.
What does the Youth Project's, what do they put behind queer prom? How do they put it together? What kind of services do they offer?
So usually the staff at the Youth Project would create queer prom. But this year we had our very first Youth Pride Board in Cape Breton. And I'm actually the co-chair of the Pride Board, one of the co-chairs. And this year we got to have a lot of more hands-on with a lot of the decisions for queer prom. So we had youth in the community vote on the theme, which the theme this year was celestial, and they loved it. The stars were a little crazy, but it was fun. Yeah, so the Youth Pride Board partnered with the Youth Project this year to create queer prom.
Have you guys been to any queer proms before this year? Have you attended any before?
I actually got to grow up with queer prom, so I attended as an attendee, volunteer, and now I get to help work for queer prom.
And what do you think is the importance of it? Do you think it'll still continue to be a thing that's needed in the years coming?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we have youth aging out and new youth coming in, so I think it's really important for all of those folks to be able to get that experience.
What would you say to a youth who is in high school currently, knows they have prom coming up in a couple years, but won't feel safe going to their own for whatever reason?
It's welcome to all youth ages between 12 and 18 to come and celebrate prom with your friends and to also get that chance to socialize with your graduating friends and to celebrate your year as well.
Have you guys heard any stories from youth about like how queer prom has enhanced kind of their graduating year?
I get to hear all the time lovely stories from queer prom and just seeing their faces light up as they talk about the experience and how lovely it was. It really brings a lot of joy to me and it makes it just so much more worth it doing. Some really heartfelt stories I hear is when a youth for the first time got to wear a tux, something that they always wanted to wear. And they had a bunch of people surround them, cheering them on, telling them that they looked amazing and just firsthand getting to see that too was amazing.
We also do have, leading up to the queer prom, lots of formal wear available in our comfort closet. So it's something that youth love to do in the weeks leading up to it. You know, they'll go back into our dressing room, if you will, try a dress on and come on out. And everyone, like Isaac said, will cheer them on and hype them up. So, you know, it's a great opportunity, especially if you can't afford something like a prom dress or a new tux. We have lots of options available for all of the youth.
And it isn't something kind of we want to think about, but if a youth wanted to attend, if just with the current political climate, they're concerned about safety, what are the kind of measures or precautions you guys have in place?
So we have lots of safety measures. We always have eyes on the door. There is always at least 3 staff in an area, especially during queer prom. So this year we had it an outside inside queer prom. So we had at least 2 staff in each room, and outside we had about 5 staff just even around the area. On top of that, we also have people who act as security guards. So ensuring just that safety, and we block off at the entrance into the venue just to make sure we don't have vehicles coming in as well.
And what you said, it was the first kind of inside outside. I know this is the first queer prom held in Eldoweg. How was that?
Phenomenal. Honestly, the space itself is just so beautiful. So getting to utilize that and its area has been amazing and has been fantastic. And the youth really just like really already engaged with the space itself. So it came out wonderful.
And as someone who's kind of grown up with queer prom, do you have a personal favorite year or like a theme, a memory?
So this is actually the first year that we did a theme, and it's going to be continuing on. So every year now, the Youth Pride Board is going to be guiding that. I have very fond memories of my first queer prom. It was almost like my first like big queer dance. So I just met so many friends and friends that I still have today, and just it's such a fond memory to hold, and definitely being young to get that opportunity to just have queer joy and to feel safe and have fun without worrying about, you know, what people are thinking.
And what would you say to a youth who wants to come out like the next year, the next time you have the queer prom, or, you know, knows they have it coming up?
Well, I would just say definitely come. You know, we usually charge $5 or pay with what you can. So, you know, even if you don't have $5, then still come. The event's going to happen either way. We have lots of snacks, music. We usually have a drag show. We have prizes. And it's just a good time. So, you know, even if you're not 100% sure, try it out. And then the next year you'll know.
Where can someone find more information about not only Queer Prom, but the other things that the Youth Project does and the things they do throughout the year?
Absolutely. You can find out more about the Youth Project either on the Youth Project website, or we're mainly active here in Cape Breton, the Youth Project Facebook page. And you can also find it on the Instagram page as well.
Summertime is a season of travel, fun in the sun, and entertainment, but those extra expenses can be stressful to those who are dealing with debt. The Coast 89.7's Brooklyn Campbell has a conversation with BDO Vice President Paul Ignatiuk.
Can you give me an overview of some of the extra expenses that Maritimers should consider budgeting for when making their summer plans?
Well, of course, there's a lot of expenses that are hidden that people don't always realize. And first of all, if you are making summer plans, you know, we got to look at the price of gas. And that's one thing that people always forget about when they go away, is that you do have to fill up with gas. And that can be very expensive. And considering what we don't know what's going on with the tariffs, and of course, with what the U.S. is doing over in the Middle East. So that is one of the big things. But there's other costs that really are going to be affected this year. If you're doing that staycation and you're going to be planning, you know, barbecue at home, you know, the cost of groceries has been increasing over the last couple of years. And, you know, that's one of the things that have been driving inflation. So when when thinking about plans for this year, it's all those little extras as well, especially when you have young children and you want to be out and about. They're always going to be wanting to grab some sort of food out, and they're the ones that really you're going to hear a lot the most from as well. Unfortunately, not always our bank account until afterwards, but it's going to be the children when you're out and about.
Many people considering using credit to cover these extra costs. How would you suggest implementing a budget without sacrificing experience?
That's right. Credit cards are so easy to use. However, if you plan ahead, there is not always a reason to use your credit card, or if you're going to be able to use your credit card to pay it off as well. Creating a summer budget is one of the key areas that you can do that. Now, we already use our budgets on a monthly basis. However, with the summer budget, it's a little different. What you're going to do is you're going to be working off your regular budget. So once you have paid off all your bills, all your expenses that you need to pay in that month, or within the next couple of months, see what how much money that you have left. That is really becoming your summer budget there. And when you have that summer budget in place, that's where you can start looking at where am I going to be spending? What am I going to be doing as well? And in order to stick to it, shop around. Don't decide on the first thing you want to go do, because there's plenty of options, especially here in Cape Breton, of things that you can go do, you know, with your family, the beaches, of course, the great sites that we do have here, the historic parts. So take a look around and shop around at what you want to do, because that is one of the key things of sticking to your budget.
What debt solutions are available for those who may already need it?
Well, definitely, if you are worried about summer, if your debt stress is high because of summer and you're going to be going out, there are various options that you can employ as well. First of all, when you come meet with a debt professional, we talk about all your various options, something as simple as budgeting. One of the key stats here, especially in Canada, is that half of Canadians don't have budgets. So sometimes sitting down and working on a budget, either creating one or reworking one, can actually free up some additional cash for you. Other solutions that are available are, you know, interest rates have been coming down. They are not as low as they were. However, now is a time if you want to look at doing some sort of a debt consolidation, especially if you're using credit cards that are about 19%. Debt consolidations are closer to 10%. Other than that, you can also take a look at formal debt solutions, such as consumer proposals and bankruptcies. Now, despite people, you know, filing bankruptcies, it's a myth that people are not going to be able to have fun, that people are not going to have money to go out and do things as well. So when we meet with people, we talk about all the various debt solutions that are available, and we provide the options that's going to be really best for that individual.
You talk about the myth of people believing that maybe they wouldn't have money left over. I'm wondering, what other issues do you see come up that scares people from dealing with their debt?
Well, one of the things is that people feel like they're going to be judged, that, you know, we're going to be sitting in front of them and telling them that they've done bad things. No, you know what? We talk about solutions. We talk about moving forward. We talk about, you know, what your future is going to be. The other myths out there about finding your debt help is, you know, really that you're never going to have credit again. Well, that's not the whole point of finding a debt solution. A debt solution is talking about how we deal with your debt stress right now, your credit right now, and set you up for a future where that if you want to have credit again, definitely you can.
Finally, school is out, but learning doesn't stop. What are some ways that parents can use the summer as an opportunity to teach children about financial literacy?
I find summer is really the perfect time to sit with children and talk about financial literacy. Number one, for the older children that are going to be getting summer jobs this year, and especially those that are going to be going off to college or university in the fall, it's a great opportunity to talk about how you save money as well and how you're going to need it for the future. But for the younger children, there's a lot of things that you can do. You can talk to them about the difference of needs and wants, because that is going to be very important. But when it comes also down to creating your summer budget, you can also have your children involved in it. Because what it's going to show them, it's going to show them a number of teachable moments, not only teachable moments, but bonding moments. It's going to allow them to participate, have that fun in making the plans. But it's also going to show them that if you have a summer budget, you have to stick within that plans. So you need to make the proper and wise decisions.
Fantastic, Paul. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today.
Oh, no problem. Anytime you need someone to have an interview, I'm happy to help.
That was Paul Anadiuk, Vice President and Licensed Insolvency Trustee at BDO Debt Solutions, discussing how Maritimers can follow a spending budget this summer without sacrificing fun in the sun.
That's all for Dialogue this week. If you have an idea for an interview on the program, send us an email to news@coastalradio.ca. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.